May it please the court?
Certainly.
Nearly 18 months ago, Anthony Bowman entered into a binding plea agreement with the state of Missouri. In that binding plea agreement, he pled to a misdemeanor receiving stolen property, was given a suspended imposition of sentence, and was placed on 2 years of bench probation. 9 months after accepting that binding plea agreement, respondent in the state of Missouri violated the terms of that binding plea agreement. On April 22nd of 2016, respondent ordered Anthony Bowman to pay restitution in the amount of $4,139, restitution which was never part of the binding plea agreement. What we are asking this court to do here today is to make the preliminary writ issued permanent and to prohibit respondent from ordering Anthony Bowman to pay restitution and further to order specific performance of that binding plea agreement. There's really one question before the court today, and that's whether respondent abused his discretion by ordering restitution in the case. While there is that one overarching question, there are several subparts to it. The first one, did respondent have the authority to order restitution when there was already a binding plea agreement in place that he had accepted 9 months earlier? And I think that the answer is clearly no. In Rule 24.02D, it gives the circuit court the authority to accept a plea agreement as is and incorporate that into their sentence and judgment, or it gives them the authority to reject the plea agreement at that time, notify all of the parties, and at that time give the defendant an opportunity to withdraw their guilty plea and let them know if they pursue that guilty plea that there may be harsher consequences than they may have anticipated. In this case, Anthony Bowman entered into that plea on July 31st, 2015. The court accepted it. There was no questions, there was no rejection, or notifying Anthony Bowman that the plea agreement would not be accepted at that time. And so I think it's clear that the binding plea agreement is in effect and all parties should be bound by it.
And what were the terms of the binding plea agreement?
The binding plea agreement was simply that they would reduce it from a felony of receiving stolen property to a misdemeanor receiving stolen property charge, that he would be given a suspended imposition of sentence and placed on 2 years of bench probation.
And were there any express provisions as to the conditions of probation?
There were not any specific conditions. With bench probation, a lot of the times it's simply just staying out of trouble and not bring yourself before the court for any law violation.
Is it your position that if the court had added any particular condition to probation, that would violate the binding plea agreement?
Yeah, if they basically, whenever we do plea negotiations every day, we're deciding whether they're going to send someone to prison, whether they're going to send someone to jail, whether they're going to place someone on probation. And part of it, if they're going to place someone on probation, we decide what specific conditions we're going to have them do. Do they need to do drug treatment because they have a drug problem? Do they need
I guess my point is, are you suggesting that every single term and condition of probation that a judge might think is appropriate during the term of probation, for whatever reason, has to be in the initial plea agreement if it's a binding plea, or it's forever bidden to be added as a condition?
If it is a binding plea agreement, yes. However, there is one caveat to that. If the person did find themselves before the court for a violation of their probation, at that time the court could say, okay, you did violate your probation, but instead of extending it or giving you a new term or sending you to jail, I'm going to give you another chance. But because you had this drug violation, I am going to make you do drug treatment as part of that.
And what's your law that supports that? That the trial court doesn't have discretion as to appropriate terms that can be modified during the term of probation without a violation?
Well, 559.021, it does give the circuit court jurisdiction to modify or enlarge the terms of probation at any time during that period. But based on Rule 24.02D, it addresses binding plea agreements and non-binding plea agreements. And it's clear that...
And again, you said there was nothing in the plea agreement that covered the terms of probation.
That there was no specific terms of probation. In general, you're still required to do the general terms of probation.
Well, makes those general terms binding, but the non-general terms non-binding?
Because general terms are what are part of every probation term.
How do I know that restitution is not part of every probation term that includes a property?
Because whenever there's restitution, that we've always considered that to be a specific term of someone's probation. There's not going to be restitution in every case, and there's not always a defendant who is responsible for restitution. And so that's clear that that would be a fact scenario. You have to look at what facts are in that case to determine if restitution even exists and if this person is responsible for that restitution.
And I understand you're talking about your practice and what generally people understand. Is there anything in the rules or in prior cases that gives formal formality to that general practice and means that a court has to follow it?
There is one case that I'm aware of Santabella versus New York. In that case, The court said that the prosecutor was required to follow the terms of that binding plea agreement, and whenever they tried to back out, they had to give the defendant some sort of recourse. Due process required them to enforce the plea agreement as is, or to allow them to withdraw that plea agreement. I think the same would be true if a circuit judge, or in this case where the state of Missouri filed a motion to revoke someone's probation for failure to pay restitution, and then add that as condition of their probation. That's the state requesting the respondent to go against the plea agreement that was already accepted.
How are we to know what's a general term that the court has authority to impose and what's not?
Well, in Missouri, there is a white book for probation and parole that kind of...
I'm sorry, say it
that's
again.
That's okay. There's basically a probation and parole book that has several general terms listed. General terms, you know, you can't violate any laws, you can't have any weapons, those types of things. But anything that is fact-specific, for example, if restitution is in a case or if someone was drunk driving, they need to do Statop, drug treatment, those things are going to be fact-specific and aren't necessary for every case. So it really is, you ask the question, is this condition something that applies to all fact scenarios, or is it only specific fact scenarios that it would apply to?
Those things might be found in your manual, but where is that in Missouri law?
You know, I don't know of a specific case that it is in Missouri law, but basically on the case law, whenever we have Rule 24.02D saying they must accept a binding plea agreement as is, and we have other cases like Sanibel versus New York where they're saying, you know, we support...
Probation, I mean, the court accepted the binding plea and granted probation. It doesn't have any conditions of probation in the plea agreement, standard or non-standard. So if you look at the statute, it looks like the court could fill in all the blanks of the conditions, whether general, specific, or not, so long as it felt like it was contoured to the type of offense.
And I don't think that was what the statute does, because if you look at all of the probation statutes as a whole and you read them together to kind of harmonize them, if you look at Section 559-100, that one specifically gives the court the authority to impose probation conditions to ensure the successful completion of probation. Well, successful completion of probation, you know, there are terms such as if we have someone who is suffering from a drug addiction, we want to make sure that we're getting them the drug treatment so they can complete their probation successfully and become a productive member of society. But whenever you have restitution, especially nearly halfway through someone's probation term, and you just add that as a condition of the probation, you're not doing that to ensure the successful completion of their probation. If anything, you're ensuring their failure of probation because you've just made them have to do an accelerated payment plan. Instead of having their full term of probation to pay that restitution amount, you've now given them half the time to do it. And for my client in this situation, he's asked to pay $4,139. If this court ordered that respondent did not abuse his discretion, we'd be asking him to pay $690 in this last 6 months.
Which, if the court took action against him, you could come back to court and argue that he didn't have the ability to pay and therefore the court violated the law by revoking his probation for failure to pay. Before your time runs out, can you address your argument that there is not the trial court abused its discretion because the restitution ordered to pay was not in fact a loss caused by the defendant's conduct?
Absolutely. So in this case, Mr. Bowman was not arrested for burglary. He wasn't charged with burglary. He never pled guilty to burglary, and he was not convicted of burglary. His specific charge was receiving stolen property. In Section 559-105, specifically says any person who pleads guilty or is convicted of an offense can be ordered to pay restitution for the victim's losses due to that offense. And so in this case, it's whether a respondent can order Anthony Bowman to pay restitution for receiving stolen property, not burglary, which he's done. The $4,139 is the total losses of the victim in this case for the burglary, something he was never arrested for, never pled guilty to. And so it is clear that he does not have the authority to make him pay restitution for a burglary, a crime that he was not guilty of, and something he certainly didn't plead guilty to or was convicted of.
The property that he was charged with receiving, that was stolen property, was that property recovered?
It was. It was all recovered, and that's clear because if we look at the probable cause statement, which was taken as part of the record at the restitution hearing, they list several miscellaneous items, including like a JVC VCR player and a chocolate-covered binder with CDs. And then they note on there, all items were seized and taken into evidence. Christina Moore testified that she received all of those items back. So really the question is, was there any restitution from those items? And that would be if they were damaged or not. Well, Christina Moore answered that question herself at the restitution hearing because I asked her if any of those items were damaged. I think her response, I don't know the exact quote, but it was a backpack and some cocoa butter that was given to her. So it was so insignificant that she didn't include it on the list of restitution. And so if Anthony Bowman owed anything, it would be relating to the insignificant damages that she didn't even feel necessary to include as part of the restitution. In addition, I think it's important to highlight respondent's response in this case, wherever he indicated that his finding was he probably some property was received by Anthony Bowman but was not recovered by Christina Moore. Well, first off, that finding was mere speculation because there was no evidence presented of it at all. But second off, if you look at that, if he found some property was probably recovered, then why is he ordering restitution for all of the property that she lost as a result of the burglary? His own rulings are inconsistent with and of themselves, and I think that shows that he clearly abused his discretion and simply made his rulings based off mere speculation. There just simply was no evidence of that. I think one other thing to address is the fact that whenever we go back to a binding plea agreement, is whenever if restitution was part of a binding plea agreement, there's a box for it on that plea agreement. So we have to look at the plea agreement itself. It's the plea of guilty and the sentence of judgment. It was signed by Anthony Bowman. It was signed by respondent. It was signed by the prosecuting attorney at the time and the defense attorney. There is a specific box that says restitution, a blank, where you can put the amount of it in and you can put them to pay it within so many days. That box is not checked on the signed plea agreement that was accepted by the court on July 31st, 2015. And so when we go to what individuals testified, their memory about, you know, thousands of cases that they handled and what their memory was as to that one specific case, and we really can't even get to their testimony because we have to look at the document itself. It's unambiguous. It was not checked, and it was not part of that binding plea agreement.
What about the cases that suggest it's the oral plea agreement made at the plea transcript as opposed to the written plea agreement that governs?
Well, that question is easily answered because in this case, whenever we have misdemeanor pleas, we don't do oral transcript on the record. It simply is that document and the court signs it, so there is no transcript on that record.
Well, so do we just ignore those cases that suggest that the oral record is what governs it? Or do you just say there was no oral record of the plea in this case?
I don't think we necessarily ignore the oral record because I think that that can speak high volumes as to what actually happened amid a plea hearing. But in this case, there wasn't an oral record.
And was it the defense attorney's responsibility to make sure there was an oral record? And if the defense attorney failed to do that, then that operates to the defendant's prejudice?
No, I don't think that it's the defense attorneys to make sure it's on the record. I think that would be up to the court to make sure that they're doing their duty to put
something
on the record.
Does a law to the cases support your position?
I think Rule 24.02d makes it clear that the circuit court must put it on the record, for example, if they're rejecting a plea agreement. And so I think that that would make it clear as well that it would be their duty to place something like that on the record.
You're saying it's common practice not to make a record?
On misdemeanor pleas in St. Francis County, it's common practice that there is not a record made. If it is a felony plea, there is a record.
Your time is up. Thank you. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
May it please the court? Mm-hmm. I'm Ariel Poulet, and I represent the respondent, Honorable Judge Timothy Inman. In this case, there's really two issues. Did the trial court have the power to amend the relator's probation, and did the trial court abuse its discretion when it amended relator's probation? The trial court modified the conditions of probation to include restitution. The legislature gives the court this power in 559.021.7. Additionally, the trial court was within the allotted time frame. Even if the guilty plea did not expressly provide for restitution, the statutes do not require the court to order restitution at the time of the guilty plea or sentencing. 559.021 states that when a defendant is placed on probation, he or she shall be given a certificate explicitly stating the conditions on which he or she is being released. No time frame is placed on this. According to State Ex Rel Doe v. Moore, the court may modify or enlarge the conditions of probation at any time prior to the expiration or termination of the probation term under Section 559.021. In this case, the motion to amend conditions of probation was filed 6 months after the defendant pled guilty. not to mention the fact that the state was under the impression that the defendant was ordered to pay restitution as part of the probation at the guilty plea, as evident in the state filing a motion to revoke for failure to pay only 4 months
and after the guilty plea. And what does the state base that on if it wasn't in the written plea agreement and there was no oral agreement bit on the record?
The state bases that on the fact that it's written in the state's file, that it's written in the defense's file, and according to the testimony from that was presented at the probation amendment hearing, the judge talked to the prosecutor and the defense counsel that was on during that time, and they both said that restitution was discussed, the restitution amount was mentioned and written down in both files. And
you're saying the defense file said $4,000 was owed and that was part of the agreement?
It said it inside their physical file. It was written down in their notes, yes.
And so we should go by that, and we don't we normally decide things on the record in a criminal or civil case?
Yes, that's correct. So at first we went by our records that were in our office, and when we realized...
No, not your records in your office, the court's records.
Okay, yes. Well, so that's why we filed the motion to revoke, but once we realized the court's records did not have that, we then filed a motion to amend conditions of probation, and a hearing was held at a later date.
It was that hearing on the record?
Yes, that hearing was on the record, and it's Exhibit 10 in defense's brief.
And what did the defense say about agreement to pay restitution?
In that agreement, the defense counsel said that it was not a part of the plea agreement, and then when they were asked if it was written in their file and if it was discussed at another time, they stated that yes, it was, but there during negotiations.
Is this where there was an earlier plea where they asked for restitution and that was rejected, and then this later when the defense's position was that they didn't want to pay restitution and that wasn't part of the final agreement?
Yes, the defense said that it wasn't part of the final agreement.
It was not, okay. And
correct.
Their record does not show it was part of final agreement.
Correct. The written plea form does not have restitution on the written plea form. That's correct.
Why was the hearing not on the record? Why are misdemeanor hearings not on the record?
That is court policy. It's the judges make a determination that when we're in court that all misdemeanor pleas be written, and then they just accept them, they review them, they sign them, and it's continued.
And what was the written plea agreement has a box for restitution that was not checked.
That's correct. I would also
note. So why
note,
isn't that the plea agreement?
I would also note that the restitution has a box for not violating any further laws, which the relator just stated was a general term of the plea agreement, and that box was not checked either. Actually, no boxes
so
were checked.
So you're bound by the written plea agreement, but you're not bound by the written plea agreement.
We are bound by the written plea agreement, and then that's why we filed a motion to amend conditions of probation, and that's why we had the hearing. And our basis is that based on the hearing, the judge made a determination in his discretion that restitution should be added, that there were negotiations about restitution, and in addition, that the restitution should be, or the relator is responsible for the restitution based on his charge and what the restitution was for.
And could that be done at any time during the period of probation, the last month of probation?
Yes, that's what State Ex Rel Doe v. Moore says. As long as the probation term has not expired or terminated, it can be done.
And without any violations having occurred?
Correct.
Do you agree with the relator's characterization that this was a binding plea, that the court was bound to either accept or reject under 2402?
No, I do not agree with that.
Okay. What was your understanding, or what's your position with respect to the nature of the agreement?
I think that the nature of the agreement is binding until you have a hearing on amending probation, and at that time the judge has the ability to change the conditions of probation. The time frame amount of time is based on Doe v. Moore, and the amount that he has the ability and the power to change it is based on 559.021.7.
Could the trial court have changed it at the time it was presented, before it was accepted? Could the trial court have added provision for restitution or provision for shock time or some other extraordinary provision?
I believe that if it's prior to the judge accepting, are you saying prior to the judge accepting
yes.
the plea or after? Prior,
yeah.
yes, because the judge is not bound by our agreement.
Well, that doesn't sound like what the rule refers to as a binding plea, which the trial court can either accept in whole or reject in whole.
Correct. I think that For example, if the trial court, if we had a suspended imposition of sentence, 2 years bench probation, but the trial court wanted to add the conditions of restitution before he accepted it, I believe that the trial court could have, in effect, rejected it in whole, made his whole a whole new term of probation, a whole new agreement of probation, and still done an SIS, or a suspended imposition of sentence, two years.
The trial court had rejected it. The trial court said, no, I'm going to do a longer period of probation, or I'm going to do restitution. I'm unhappy with these terms.
That is,
and it's a binding plea. The defendants would be allowed to withdraw their plea and proceed to trial if that was their choice. Are you saying that that's what would have had to happen, or that these were just your recommendations and the trial judge was free to accept or reject them in part?
I'm saying that these are just state recommendations, and the court is allowed to change his recommendation up until the point after the defendant pleads guilty.
But that's not true if it's a binding plea agreement. Was this a binding plea agreement, and that's the way it's been presented to this court?
No discussion was had about a binding plea agreement. I'm under the impression that it was considered binding at the point when all three parties, meaning the state, the defense, and the judge, signed it. And
that's our question.
Okay.
At the time it was presented to the court, it was presented as a binding plea agreement so the court could accept it or reject it. If the court rejected it, then the defendant could make the choice whether to plea or not, could withdraw their plea. I'm not addressing whether you could modify it later. The questions that have been asked go to, at the time it's presented to the court, was it a binding plea agreement the court had to accept or reject under our rule?
No, the fact that it was binding or not was not discussed prior to the judge signing it. I argue that it's only binding once the judge signs it. And it was not discussed, and it was not a term of the agreement that it was binding. The second issue is whether the court abused its discretion when it amended relator's probation. In order to establish an abuse of discretion, the relator must show that a reasonable person could not...
Was it an open plea, or did you just make a recommendation, or had you and defense counsel reached an agreement as to the disposition, which you presented to the judge?
We had reached an agreement. It was not an open plea, and that information was signed and put on the misdemeanor probation form, and the judge, it is my position that the judge could have modified that when he reviewed the probation, the written plea form, and signed it at the end. Once he signed it, he could not modify it until there was a hearing held.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Okay. So in order to show an abuse of discretion, relator must show that a reasonable person could not differ as to the propriety of the actions taken by the trial court. And there are multiple reasons a reasonable person could find that the Honorable Judge Inman's actions were proper. First, is the restitution amount is contributable to the victim's losses due to the offense of receiving stolen property. According to Article 1, Section 32, Subsection 4 of the Missouri Constitution, the victim has a right to restitution. Property was stolen from the victim that totaled the amount of $4,064. That property, a portion of that property, was found in the possession of relator. The fact is whether that property in total was at one time in the possession of the relator. That fact is not at issue. What is at issue is a reasonable person could find still that the relator is liable for the missing property for various reasons. One, including that if the relator would have come forward and stated where the property he received came from, perhaps the victim could have been made whole in their entirety, regardless of whether the location be in the possession of the relator or in possession of a co-defendant of the relator.
What evidence did the state present? Was there a hearing, or was there a trial on the issue of where the other property went, who stole it, what was in defendant's possession? What evidence was presented on those issues?
The evidence that was presented on the issues of where the restitution was, is that correct?
No. All the other things that were stolen that the judge ordered defendant to pay restitution for, what evidence was there on the record to show that they were in defendant's possession, that he had received them as stolen property?
There was no evidence presented on that issue.
So on what basis could the court order him to pay restitution for a crime which he had not been shown to have committed?
The court is allowed to review the entire record, and when the judge reviewed both the probable cause statement and the victim's testimony.
You just told me there was no evidence.
There's no hard evidence that said he was.
But there's evidence or not evidence? What do you mean?
There is circumstantial evidence that the judge could read into the probable cause statement that he was in possession of some of the property, that the reason that we found he was in possession of that property was because someone came forward and said he paid old debts by giving me some of this stolen property. And so when the police found out that this other party received stolen property, they said...
And we know that from a probable cause statement. We didn't have any testimony?
We didn't have any testimony from the friend of the relator that said he received stolen property from the relator. No, we did not have testimony at the amended...
And that wasn't
hearing.
Part of the plea agreement? He didn't plead guilty to that?
He
to giving stolen property to a friend? He didn't plead guilty to that?
In receiving stolen property,
we're talking about, I know, but the other property you're saying.
Yes, I believe that when it was amended to a misdemeanor, we had to adjust the complaint so that it was under $500. Mm-hmm. So we just said the DVD player in that complaint. But the original complaint, the felony complaint, said multiple
that's what
items.
The first charge was, but that's not what he pled guilty
correct.
To. Thank
correct.
You.
Yes. Okay, so... the second form of reasoning that a reasonable person could find that Judge Inman's actions were proper is through the testimony that we already discussed at the probation amendment hearing, where evidence was presented that both the state and the defense had notes in their files, that the state first filed the motion to revoke because they were under the impression that restitution was part of the original plea agreement. All these can and were considered by Judge Inman when he was deciding whether to amend relator's probation. In addition, I would like to discuss a few of the arguments that Relator presented. Their main argument is the restitution was not the victim's losses due to Relator's convicted crime of receiving stolen property, but the restitution was due to a burglary that occurred. The Honorable Judge Inman did not state in his reasoning for applying the restitution was for damages to a building as a result of Relator knowingly entering or remaining unlawfully in the victim's home. None of that, the fact that Relator was present or not present in the victim's home was not discussed by the judge at all in the amendment hearing. At most, the added condition of restitution was attributable to stealing, not burglary. And as Relator argues with the Blockberger test, we can apply the Blockberger test to receiving stolen property and stealing. The applicable rule is whether each provision requires proof of a fact which the other does not. So stealing is when a person appropriates property or services of another with the purpose to deprive him or her thereof, either without his or her consent or by means of deceit or coercion. While receiving is when a person, for the purposes of depriving the owner of his lawful interest, he or she retains, receives, or disposes of property of another knowing that it has been stolen or believing that it has been stolen. Retaining, which is in the definition of receiving stolen property, is in the definition of appropriating, which is part of the statute for stealing. And both statutes require the defendant to deprive the owner of their property without their consent. And therefore, the similarity between these two charges shows that a reasonable person could find that it is proper for contributing the restitution of stealing to the crime of receiving stolen property and vice versa because of the similarity of the crime.
Your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, the court.
Counsel, before you start,
sure.
I don't see the argument that adding this term after accepting the plea agreement violated the binding nature of the plea agreement. I don't see that in your petition. I don't see it in your suggestions, and I don't see it in your point relied on. Did I miss it?
No, Judge. Actually, in my reply brief, I do note because they talk about it being part of the binding the plea agreement. In my prayer for relief, I indicate that not only did they abuse their discretion pursuant to 559-105, but they also said that restitution was part of the agreement when it was not part of the binding plea agreement.
We don't ordinarily take up new issues in the reply brief, let alone the prayer for relief in the reply brief. Why should we do that here? The argument I read in your petition was that the statute didn't authorize restitution, and even if it did, the evidence didn't support it.
And that is still one of my arguments here today, but I know that the court is also addressing a similar issue of whether restitution was part of that agreement. And I think that kind of goes to 559-105, because if it wasn't part of the plea agreement at any cost, then we wouldn't even get to whether he abuses discretion or 559-105. So that's kind of a prerequisite question that has to be answered before we get whether someone abused their discretion pursuant to 559-105. Respondent had indicated several things just a second ago, and one of those was that the respondent didn't find him guilty of burglary. But in a sense, he really did, because what happened is he found that he was responsible for all of these items that were stolen during the course of a burglary. Those items were never attributed to Anthony Bowman. There was no evidence presented that he was responsible for those items. And so respondent was attempting to circumvent the process and find him guilty of burglary to compensate the victim for her loss of due to the burglary.
Your argument is really that absent finding him guilty of burglary, he had no basis to order him to pay restitution.
That's correct.
All those things, and he did not find him guilty of burglary.
That's correct. He did not plead guilty. He was not convicted of burglary. There was no evidence to support that he was guilty of the burglary. And so you can't order restitution for a burglary when there was no evidence to support he was guilty of burglary.
What about the items that he passed on to a third party?
I'm sorry, say that again, please.
The items he supposedly had but then passed on to a third party.
So there's only evidence.
It came into evidence how exactly again?
So there's a probable cause statement, and then the probable cause statement, it notes that how the police had Anthony Bowman on their radar was someone had received stolen property from Anthony Bowman and said that he was paying off a debt. Well, that property ended up being the victims in this case, and that's how they first went to question Anthony Bowman. It's important to note that that individual who had received the property from Anthony Bowman, that property was also recovered by Christina Moore, and that was the only piece of evidence which wasn't presented in any formal hearing. It was solely in a probable cause statement. That is the only evidence that Anthony Bowman had given any property to an third-party person. And that property, too, was recovered. There is no evidence that he gave any other property to another third party that was not recovered in this.
There's no admission by the defendant that he actually did that.
I'm sorry, say that again.
There's no admission by the defendant that he actually did
that. That's correct. There was no admission by the defendant that he had anything to do with giving property that was not recovered. Another thing that I think it's important to address here is what would be the proper recourse for Anthony Bowman. And part of the proper recourse for Anthony Bowman would be to enforcing the specific plea agreement in this case, doing specific performance. If we simply allow him to withdraw his plea, we're subjecting the injured party to harsher consequences of felony.
I'm looking at his plea agreement, the written plea agreement, and I don't see anything that says it's binding.
Judge, whenever we do plea agreements, what happens is we talk to the state about what the agreement is. Whenever we come up to an agreement with the state, if it's not binding, then what we're doing is essentially an open plea, or the state simply is saying, you can ask for whatever you want, I'm not going to oppose it. But whenever we fill out a misdemeanor plea form, it is the state's understanding that that is the plea agreement and the judge will file it. It is our understanding that that is the plea agreement, that the judge will file it or follow that plea agreement. And if not,
But there's nothing in the plea agreement that tells the judge that.
That's correct. There's nothing that specifically says binding plea agreement on the form itself.
Of course, there's a way for parties to make sure judges understand. They can cite the rule that says what's a binding agreement, or they could cite the rule that says this is a joint recommendation. But in this case, or in your county, you've just chosen to do neither?
Right. There has not been any formal written thing on there pursuant to what rule it was. However, I think that we focus on we're a jurisdiction that thinks that we need to tell defendants exactly what they're pleading to and make sure they understand their terms completely. And one of those would be if it was a non-binding plea agreement, if they were going to be, the judge wouldn't have to accept that. They would know that in advance, and the judge would have to, there would be some form of record then as to the judge sentencing them. And in this case, there was no record of the judge doing his plea agreement or defining his sentence that he chose to impose at that time.
Well, it was not, if they're going to vary from the plea agreement, is that put on the record?
Or if they,
you said there are no misdemeanor hearings if you're accepting the written plea. How about if you're going to not accept it or come to a different disposition?
To be perfectly honest, I haven't had that case come up simply because we always do binding plea agreements and the judges accept our plea agreements as we've handled them prior to getting in front of them.
The response you gave to Judge Fisher as to what the practice of the prosecutor and defense counsel is in a public defender in your county, is that on the record?
I don't think that the practice is on the record. It's just kind of everyday dealings.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Also, so in this case, your client really wouldn't have known that he wasn't to violate the law on probation because that box wasn't checked either.
I think that there are general terms that are a part of every plea agreement, and so you can't go violate the law. I mean, that's one thing whenever we're advising clients, hey, this is bench probation, you don't have to be supervised, but just don't go out there getting arrested for a new crime. I mean, that's something generally that we do tell clients just because it is a general term of probation. Correct.
Any other questions? Thank you. Case
Thank
will
you.
Be submitted.